We're talking with Illumina about clinical genetics next on the program. Welcome to Mendel's Pod. I'm Theral Timpson. I'm pleased to be hosting someone from the leading sequencing company or instrument company out there today. Sam Strom is here. He's a principal scientist at Illumina and a certified clinical lab director. He's joining me to talk about some of the recent successes of the company in variant calling, but also to address some of the challenges that exist in clinical genetics. Welcome to Mendel's Pod for the first time, Sam.
Thanks, Theral. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's start by learning a little bit about you, if you don't mind. We think of Illumina as this sequencing instrument company, but you're a certified clinical lab director, PhD. I noticed you've been on the working group of ClinGen. But Illumina is very involved in making sure genetics translates to the clinic, and that's what we want to hear about. So talk to us about what you do and like an overview of this side of Illumina.
Yeah, so we feel that it's important to actually do this work and understand what it takes from the inside. So Illumina has been operating a clinical laboratory for a number of years and recently has been involved in something called the iHope program, which has been providing whole genome sequencing as a clinical laboratory service for underserved populations. And that's really the foot in the door of understanding clinical diagnostic testing. So we have a full CLIA CAP lab with pathologists, lab directors, genomic analysts, and we've been interpreting cases. We have some wonderful publications about the findings in those cases. And so that really helps Illumina understand as a company what it takes to do this work.
Everything, that's super cool. Yeah. You're in your customer's shoes.
That's right. So, I had been an Illumina customer for a very long time. When I was in grad school at UCLA, we had a Celexa, and then very quickly became Illumina customers.
Illumina.
Yeah. So I'm old enough to remember those days. And, really, it was very exciting times back then. We were first able to sort of get all this sequence out of the instruments. And I just immediately became interested in, well, what do we do with this for patients? How do we turn all of these sequence results into something that can impact families? It's been a long road. we're still working on that.
Yeah.
So I became very interested in sort of clinical diagnostics in that early exome era. So the UCLA group led by Wayne Grody and Stan Nelson and Hayden Lee, they were validating clinical exome sequencing as one of the, there was like five or six other laboratories in the country that were kind of doing it at the same time. And I was just wrapping up my PhD at that moment. And it was, to me, it was, okay, this is what I want to do with my life. I didn't know what it was until I saw this and now it's happening and I'm going to jump on this train. And so I did my fellowship there. And then after spending several years as faculty there, I moved to a company called Fulgent Genetics, which also does NGS, clinical genetic testing. And really what, when I came to Illumina about 2.5 years ago, what I really wanted to do was share that knowledge that I've learned. So the hard-earned, understanding of what it takes to interpret, genetic test results, to the masses, because it's really hard.
I love that. So let's jump in. So yeah. That's a great segue. That's what we want to talk about. For instance, variant calling has been one of the issues for many years. Different labs might call variants differently, and that's been an issue with quality control. So how big a deal is this now? And, why are variants so difficult to call?
We really learned the hard way that certain genes and certain parts of the genome just don't behave. They're complicated. Started off as, why did you miss this? And, why in this patient, you didn't diagnose them properly. You said you did, you tested the gene, but you didn't find the right answer. So I've been working with bioinformaticians ever since those sort of early days. Why did we miss that? And can we use the data? Can we look at the data in a different way than this sort of standard variant calling? In the initial days, it was just short, small variants, single nucleotide and short indels, and then going into copy number variants, to look for, you know, large things like 22q deletion syndrome. We should be able to detect that. Yes, we can, right? And then now we're kind of, and the history of it is we start off with sort of low-hanging fruit. We could get the SNVs in the clean regions. And then we've just been pushing out the boundaries with what short read technology can do as far as we can go. I remember I was at a talk, I think it was at ASHG, an Illumina alum, Igor Dolshenko, gave a talk about Expansion Hunter, which used PCR-free whole genome sequencing to look for short tandem repeats. And it had never occurred to me that that would even be possible, frankly. Like, you know, we always did PCR for Fragile X, and that was just everyday lab. You just do it. And now they're saying, you know, you can do the library prep in a certain way, do genome sequencing, and you can get repeat expansions, any repeat expansion you want. It was like hitting a candy store for me, you know, for something like Fragile X. It's so GC rich. If you do the standard library preps, the sequences wouldn't be in the libraries. It wasn't in the tube. So no informatics can rescue something that's not in the tube. But yeah, so you combine the library prep with the bioinformatics and you get this kind of magical result. And then, when I was at my last job at Fulgent Genetics, we actually validated that as a clinical assay for ataxias. I think we were the first. If anybody listening thinks they did it before us, I'd be very interested to know that. But I think we were the first clinical laboratory to validate that. And so, we have a program internally we call a fully featured genome program, where we sort of try to figure out all the things that we can do with the short reads using the algorithms. The PCR-free genome library prep hasn't actually had to change very much, which is great. It's nice to have something that kind of can be your home base. So using that wet lab assay with either, you know, any of the NovaSeq instruments or even NextSeq instruments for genomes, we just keep pushing out like, well, let's see if we can resolve this tough gene that our colleagues are struggling with. And so far,
what's a recent example of that?
So GBA or GBA1 is a big one.
Okay.
It's important for Gaucher disease and Parkinson's disease. You mentioned I'm involved with ClinGen. I'm deeply involved with the Parkinson's community. I'm one of the co-chairs of the curation expert panel for Parkinson's disease.
Oh, cool.
And GBA is like the big one in that community. It's really tough. There's a pseudogene. You have false negatives. You have false positives that can occur. But the Illumina bioinformatics team took a look at those regions and came up with a targeted caller that can get all the important genetic variations in GBA using whole genomes. So that's one. HBA 1 and 2 is another one that's really, really important. One of the most common genetic diseases in the world for alpha thalassemias. There are two genes. They're very similar to each other. They cause a lot of interference. And the team here, led by a guy named Chinois, developed an algorithm, and thing works and it's beautiful. And so I've been working with them to make sure that they, like, we're targeting the right genes, but also we're proving that they really work on real patient samples, which can be difficult, to get all the right positive controls together and, you know, do it right and get it orthogonally validated by a proven laboratory, you know, using other technologies. Sometimes it's a PCR test or, you know, some older technology, but we sort of put all that together. So, it's a great team atmosphere here, to sort of build the right things and then demonstrate to the world that they actually work.
Okay. So what I heard is you're the clinical, guy sort of confirming, yes, this really makes a difference out there. But then there's been the steady improvement from the inside team there, and not just in efficiency and cost, which is a lot about what we hear about at, conferences or JP Morgan or that, but improvements that have been made in the technology to allow better detection and relevant, that you're working on relevant genes.
Yeah, I'd say that there's been a couple of major areas. The first thing is that whenever you're doing any kind of variant calling, by definition, you're comparing to a reference, right? You're saying this patient or this participant or research study has a genome and it's different from the normal genome. I'm using air quotes if
this isn't the video, who's not watching.
The audio, and a difference means that there has to be a baseline. You're comparing it to something. And it turns out one of the best ways to improve variant calling is to have a better reference. And the way to have a better reference is to have it be more fleshed out than our standard flat reference. So if you think of a reference genome that's just ACGT, TCGA, GGGC, on and on and on for, you know, 3 billion letters or 6 billion letters. That's sort of, you can
think
of it as like...
We don't need to do that today.
Not on
the next podcast.
I think your editor would probably cut all of that if we did it. But...
Well, this is the age of editing genomes.
Exactly. Okay. That's funny. So if you think of that as like a 2D structure, right? It's a line. It's flat. But there's lots of humans, and not all humans are the same in their genomes, right? So at any given position, 20% of people might have an A, and 60% of people might have a T, and so on. And we can
It's not pathogenic.
No, these are just general polymorphisms, right? Mm-hmm. These are just normal variations in human populations. And that can even be copy numbers and structural variants, all these complicated things. But just to sort of start off, one of the things that the Dragon team here has done, that's our bioinformatics team, they've built a multi-sample reference that is probabilistic. So it's like a 3D version of the genome. Some people will call it like a graph genome. That's a word
that
gets
tossed around.
Yeah.
We've heard of that.
So when you align your reads to a genome that understands, you could have an A or a T here. Those are both good, sort of good calls. Then you can align more of your reads, and you can be more tolerant to having multiple variants in the same read, including things like indels. So if you have an indel in one part of the read and an SNV in the other part of the read, that whole read may just go away because it's going to say, like, that's a poor map. It doesn't look like the regular genome. In fact, both of those things may be totally normal and, you know, and present in 20% of people. So when you improve, again, I think the key concept is the better your reference sequence reflects human beings and their genomes, the better variant calling you're going to get. So that's the first, and that's revolutionary. It's made a huge difference in the accuracy for all kinds of variant calling.
Okay, now most people talk about reference genome coming out of the NCBI, right? You're saying you've created your own reference genomes, which is multi-sample, which the other big story is there to go towards more diversity.
Yes, absolutely. So the first thing to know is that we're using the same coordinate system as NCBI. So it's GRCH 37 or 38, whichever you want to use.
Okay.
So it's compatible with sort of the, if you say chromosome 7, this position, that's the same when you're using Dragon. It's not a totally new coordinate system. But it is something that we provide that is not available on public sites. And yes, we are every sort of, as we iterate and improve, we're adding more and more samples. You need to characterize those genomes extraordinarily well before you put them in. So we're trying to characterize as many from diverse populations to capture that human diversity that we have. And there are diminishing returns on that eventually. We started off, we had, I think, 8 or 12, and now we're going to have, in the dozens, and maybe we'll go to hundreds. Beyond that,
okay.
It really doesn't.
Yeah, I was curious.
It doesn't. You kind of get diminishing returns on it, and the compute becomes a problem, and it's expensive, and you're not really getting anything out of it. So we're continuing to improve. You can look forward to new versions of Dragon having sort of improved genomes as the reference for a while here. So then the other thing that's been really cool is to see artificial intelligence pop up in genomics. And so for the most part, the AI that we can talk about that's available right now is a little bit of the previous generation. So it's machine learning. It is neural networks. It's not the gigantic deep learning stuff. Some of it is getting there, which had some meetings this morning, internal stuff we can't talk about. It's very exciting. But the external stuff we have for Dragon, they use machine learning to train a model to improve those quality scores. So you get a variant, it says pass, and it's got a number, it's a 200, right? Like, is that good or is that bad? That's always been kind of a struggle with how do we know a good call from a bad call? It's pretty subtle. So the Dragon team has used, again, really well-characterized genomes, huge amounts of data to train a model for what about that variant call makes it good or bad. Is it the strand bias and the you know, what position in the read it's in. You know, there's all these different parameters that we can feed into the model, and then the model can sort of figure out, okay, what are the patterns of variant calling that are associated with true positivity? And so that's allowed us to better tweak the variant calls themselves. And that's now on by default in Dragon. So you get this sort of AI machine learning enhancement to the quality score calling, or the quality score calibration, as just sort of part of the deal. Now that's just normal. Every day we're just using AI for that.
Nice.
So, yeah.
So better reference genomes, and then using AI and just beefing up your algorithms and the amount of compute that's going on there, and parameters, I guess.
Yeah. And then for what I really want to get to, I'm not just on the podcast, but in real life, is, okay, well, let's start interpreting these variants. Now we've called all these things correctly, which is super important. If you have garbage in, you have garbage out, but we have no more garbage in. It's all beautiful variant calls. Now, what is this? Like, what do we do with all that, right? We're generating millions of variants, or at least tens of thousands of variants for an exome, for example. You know, how do we get to an answer? Especially in rare diseases, but also, you know, things like, you know, specific disease indications. So we have a tertiary analysis software called Imagine. It's spelled EMED gene, but pronounced Imagine, like the John Lennon song. And it's a full suite for taking that data, the output of the genome, the variant calls, and getting to a meaningful report that can go to a physician and the patient. And the Imagine tool has an incredible AI auto-analysis component to it, where it takes the phenotypes observed in the patient, or the participant, or the person being studied. So like the medical indications for why they're being tested in the first place. It takes the variants that are observed in that individual, the properties of those variants, like population frequency, conservation, what type of variant, is it a missense variant or a truncating variant? And then all sorts of information about the gene, whether it's associated with a known disease, what phenotypes go with that disease, what the mode of inheritance is, what the zygosity of the variant is. It takes all this different information about the individual that's being tested, and the variant and the gene, and these different, you know, sort of knowledge bases. And they've trained a model to pluck out the likely solving variants that are causing disease in that individual. And it's been improving. Like they were a separate company, and they joined Illumina about the same time I did, actually, about
this
two
is
years
the
ago,
Imagine,
2.5 years ago.
Imagine.
Yeah. Imagine. Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, and there's a publication from Baylor Genetics that I can recommend about their use of this in a clinical laboratory.
Very cool. I didn't know you guys were doing, I mean, this is genome interpretation.
It's genome interpretation, yeah. And right
so
now,
we always knew Illumina, you know, did the instruments, also had a lab where they could do whole genomes. But now you're talking about genome interpretation, which, you know, there are special companies for that. So
that's
you're
right.
Providing to this to some of the clinical labs out there who buy your instruments.
That's right. I think we have over 100 laboratories worldwide using Imagine as their software for genome interpretation. Some of them are using panels and exomes. Some of them are using whole genomes. And you know, this auto analysis mode, it's been improving rapidly. And right now, basically, you go from 4 million variants in a genome that are detected down to about 15. And that list of 15 variants has over a 95% chance of having the variant if there is a solving variant to find. So there are some really sort of rare exceptions where it will miss something. But in the day-to-day use of this, so we've been retrospectively looking at a lot of the cases that we've done here at Illumina. And like, it just doesn't miss. It finds all the variants that we spend hours poring over the data trying to find.
And we should say here, your Dragon team won the Precision FDA Truth Challenge.
Right. So that's
I don't know if that got involved with the Imagine yet or
so that
interpretation, but
it does not. So
it does not. That was just the calling.
Yes. The FDA stuff, you know, that really speaks to how comprehensive Dragon is and how accurate it is. And, you know, again, garbage, you know, removing your garbage in does a great job at helping.
A great help when you're interpreting.
Exactly. So it'll be interesting to see if there start to be similar types of challenges towards interpretation. There are a few other tools out there. There's some open source tools. There's some other companies that have some things. All the data that I've seen, like if I get to pick one, I would pick Imagine every day. There are other things that work, there hasn't really been much of a head-to-head quite yet. It's still such an early space, but it's really this end-to-end completeness of having, from the sample all the way to the answer, we have these different components that are all really the best in class from end to end. And, I recognize that sounds arrogant and that's a big thing to say. And we really need to prove it with strong evidence. And so that's another part of what my job is here, is to help sort of ask those questions. What type of evidence do we need to generate? How can I help customers to show what they've done to the world? Because sometimes it's easy enough to just go, especially for clinical labs, they're so busy. It's running a lab is hard work, and getting all your cases done efficiently and with good turnaround time, all that stuff is takes a lot of work. So it's important that gets shared so that people can see these just enormous efficiency gains that the Imagine software is giving to people. And there's actually a lot of quality of life things that seem really small, but can improve efficiency. So the AI is a big one, obviously. It's sort of a big ticket thing, but there's also a little feature in there where with like two clicks, you can write an automatic paragraph for a missense variant, and it pulls in all the annotations and the population frequencies and stuff about the genes, and it just writes the whole paragraph for you, and you can customize it, when you're getting set up. So every lab has sort of language that they'll want to put on a report. And for the most part, somebody actually has to type that thing out or copy paste it from a spreadsheet. Honestly, you'd be surprised.
Pretty rough.
Even just having those little quality of life things to say, oh, this is the variant, click, 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 report, done. Man, it's so much easier than it used to be.
Gotcha. Yeah. I was not aware of this full end to end. Because so much of the news coming out of Illumina is on the instrument side and the sequencing and beefing that up, like I said in the beginning, and onto NovaSeq or NovaX. But little did we know that on this interpretation, on the calling side, on interpretation side, Illumina has established their own
own so muscle. We're building an ecosystem, and I think it's important that so we call it Illumina Connected Software. We have all these different tools, but they also have multiple entry points. So we're not locking in, and it's not a walled garden. You don't have to use this stuff. We think we have the best, and if we'd love to talk to you. But if you have your own thing and you want to do that separately, especially in the research space, there's a lot of people doing stuff that we would never even know, right? There's all sorts of creative things happening, and we love that. But I think that there is sort of a happy path for clinical labs. And, I think one of the things that's really interesting to me in the medium and long term is, right now, even, academic medical centers, places that you've heard of, let's say, are capable and have the faculty and the personnel in place to bring up genetic testing. Big reference labs. Sure, right? They can hire lab directors and genomic analysts and lab techs and all these things. What about community hospitals? What about smaller places that don't have that level of sophistication? The genomics workforce is not nearly big enough to handle all the genetic testing that should be done. And
is the answer to my next question, which was this gap everyone's talking about between, those who are getting tested and those who are not, but who need testing, right? Yeah. So this is your answer to that, which is just to make the actual testing easier and more available to smaller labs.
I think it's a really important part of it. In some of the groups we've worked with, healthcare insurance providers, and looking at their policies and how those policies get enacted. And we saw in one group there was you know, there's a policy statement to offer exome or genome sequencing to any child with multiple congenital anomalies. So these are kids born with birth defects, which is an obvious area where genetics, you know, can help. You know, the diagnostic rate is 30 or 40%, and it's usually helpful in guiding management and prognosis. Only 2% of kids ever got a test, you know, and that's like the most obvious thing for me as a geneticist. Like, of course, a kid with multiple congenital anomalies should get a genome or an exome. But we're
why do you think that's not happening?
I think it's complicated, first of all. But I think there is a, I think medicine tends to move slowly, and people practice the medicine that they were taught at medical school. And that's been historically true. And genomics move very quickly. And, you know, there's a knowledge gap, I think, in the general medical community about genetics and genomics. And then there's fear, both real and maybe not as real, about cost and reimbursement, and, you know, that the parent, that the family could get stuck with a large bill. It's all sort of a very complicated, you know, it's like this tiny little piece of a very complicated American health system. It's very different across the world, but
yeah, I heard that from my doctor recently. So
yeah,
you know, she knows I do this genetic testing podcast.
Oh, interesting.
And then she forgets sometimes, you know, and she's, you know, she's promoted different tests like Cologuard, Galleri even to me.
Interesting.
You know, my regular checkup. So I asked her the other day, I said, you know, we're wondering in our industry why it's not used more. And she brought up reimbursement. She said, I just don't know it's going to get reimbursed.
Yeah. And you'll also hear things again, which are totally valid, that, you know, they aren't, you know, general practitioners are not trained to return genetic results. Like, they don't, they're not experts on these things, and they didn't get that training in medical school. And, you know, if they're very interested, they may go get it, but that's asking a lot. And this information is complex. So I think scaling up genetic counseling services is a whole other question, and providing counseling and things like that, which is, I think, in the Zoom era, there's real opportunities there, and it's not an impossible task. So I think, you know, we're chipping away at it, but I think there is a scientific component. I think it is still too difficult to do genetic testing today, considering where the technology is.
And that's the part you can address.
And I think it's mainly in putting all the pieces together. A lot of these pieces are new, right? We update our callers, you know, every 6 months or so, and we're always getting new capabilities. And this sort of, I think we crossed an inflection point for many applications like hereditary cancer and carrier screening and cardiovascular disease, where genome sequencing can now get all the variants that are needed to address those conditions in an efficient way. And we have all the software and the tools to do that. But putting all those pieces together and getting it validated and having an LDT that can do these things is not trivial. And so, you know, I think next clinical development is smoothing out that process, creating end-to-end workflows. All the stuff I'm talking about right now is in that space where the laboratories are responsible for doing their validations. And I think that's, we'll see where all that goes with the FDA. And it's, you know, a complicated regulatory space that it's not really my area of expertise, but.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's leave it there. I think it's great to hear this.
Yeah.
And maybe just to finish up, your thoughts on how it might evolve in the next few years. What do you see coming down the pike? I know Illumina is a big company and you have to be careful what you say, but, just any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think, and sort of reiterate what I was talking about a little bit earlier, I think we're at the point where the technology is pretty, the technological capabilities are pretty far ahead of what everybody is actually able to get from their doctor. So I think the next era is accessibility and integration, making it easier for health systems and hospitals and showing them that this is all possible now. And then beyond that, you know, it's going to get faster. We're going to have more capabilities to detect even more things. And the cost will continue to come down to the point where some of the barriers to you know, I think it's already getting to the point where the interpretation component is one of the biggest costs. And so we need to continue pushing on that to automate as much as we can. Shout out to places like ClinVar and ClinGen. We're going to be really reliant on that community to be curating genes and variants to say, okay, here are all the variants for, you know, hereditary breast and ovarian cancer. You don't need to do an interpretation anymore. You just need to make sure that you're checking these genes and variants.
You're checking those databases.
Mm-hmm. And you just, if somebody has a VUS that no one has ever seen before, a variant of unknown significance, you know what? That's not actionable. It's not going to get reported. The system just kind of puts that one to the side. Maybe it goes into a research database. So I think we're going to see a lot more, like to call lights out testing, where there really isn't an interpretation component to the test. It's a pure technical test and it has certain limitations, but it gets you 99.9% of the way there. And that's as far as you're ever going to get. So I think we will see that. I think we will see breakthroughs. We need to be patient, but I think the opportunity is absolutely there. And the technology, you know, 5 years ago, I wouldn't have said all this stuff. I feel confident in saying it now. It's the technology itself is already, it's putting the pieces together and really, really cranking it up.
Sam Strom, principal scientist at Illumina. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Darryl.
And okay, we got that.